Is a life simply the accumulation of all the events that happen between an individual's birth and death? Does it include only those experiences of which the individual was conscious, only those which are recalled and therefore meaningful? Is there anything comparable between one life and another? Is there anything unitary about the phenomenon of life itself? Our answer is perhaps more religious and scientific. And this is just fantastic, the way this just sort of showed up on this. Our answer is perhaps more religious and scientific. Each life harbors a mystery. Our motives are hidden even from ourselves. Our dreams, and Wayne would like that, our dreams and our impulses surprise us. They certainly, he came down every morning wondering what his dreams meant. You remember Wayne with his dreams? Every morning. One day he and I were water skiing in Lake Geneva in Wisconsin, and he was really bothered by what that meant. And we finally decided it didn't mean anything, so except we both liked to water ski, and we used up too much gas doing it. But anyway, our motives are hidden even from ourselves, and with every action we are capable of surpassing what we already are. Our future is unpredictable, the past indefinite. There is no way to map the boundaries of the soul. That's a nice way of putting it. There is no way to map the boundaries of the soul and no system for calculating its contents. We need to keep in mind that any view we take is partial. No perspective includes all perspectives. Our attempts to define a life fall short and should fall short. Were we able to make some final judgment about what a life is, we would soon attempt to make our lives fit that definition. I like that very much. That's beautifully stated. We would attempt to make our lives fit that definition. Our concept about life is never as rich as the reality to which it points. And I invite you to read the rest of this story itself. Yeah, this is a Center magazine that just came in March 1980. Some of you were here last summer, Walter Capps. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions at Santa Barbara. And this is, in a way, he's the editor of this magazine, too. So there is a Holden connection there. And tonight I want to be talking about connections too, but I'll be talking about some connections here also. Why I wrote this was really for two reasons. One was the fact that in the last 4 or 5 years we've witnessed what has been called the born-again resurgence. And so far as my own life was concerned, I had to ask myself, had I been born again? Had this really happened? And then, and if so, what does that really mean? What does it really mean to be born again? Is it just something, as Billy Graham would say, that sort of an instant historical conversion in which you know, or is it some long gradual sort of thing, or is it something in between? And secondly, 3 or 4 events in the last few years have led me to reconsider some of these things. So we'll just start off and see how far we get. And I would only ask one more thing, or suggest one more thing for all of you, and that is to keep journals, keep diaries, logs, whatever you want to call them. And sometime along the line, I think it's good maybe once a year to sit back and reflect on what happened during the year. It can be New Year's Day, it can be your birthday, whatever day it might happen to be. I think it's a very good idea to sit back and simply see how what's happened and write these things out. I always remember when I was, I can't remember the age, but I can still remember it as a sort of a dark brown book, and it was A Child's History of Robinson Crusoe. And I was terribly impressed with it. And what Crusoe had done, Defoe had done in writing Robinson Crusoe, was to have Robinson Crusoe sit down every so often and write down all the things that were wrong in his life, and then sit down and write out all the things that were right in his life, all the things that were going all right in his life. And then about every 6 months, Robinson Crusoe would sit and read the list. And that was the thing that kept him going. That all the things that he had worried about, all the things that he had feared, for all practical purposes, simply hadn't materialized. And in a way, a life story, a diary, a journal, a log, whatever you want to call it, can accomplish that with this. All right. Anyway, and some of you who are in OB won't believe this second statement of mine here, but it's true, and I've got it on the birth certificate back home, but we'll go right through it anyway. As I say, my struggle to be born at all, talking about being born again, my struggle to be born at all is a fitting prologue to our search for understanding the born-again experience. I emerged into the world as a 12-pound, and I repeat 12, that's true, a 12-pound, one-month overdue, breached, fourth child, third son of Oscar and Laura Jorstad of Kenyon, Minnesota in 1930. After my failure to appear when due, Dad drove Mother in the Hupmobile over plowed fields, literally to shake her up to induce a little labor. OB has come, some distance. Anyway. to induce labor. The moment of birth came on our kitchen table, directed by Dr. Nesset and his aunt, and my aunt, Alice Foxland. I remember one day I was talking about the Depression. I don't know if you were in there, that class, that day, Tom, but we're talking about how tough things were in the Depression. And I just happened that this was a throwaway line, that I was born on the kitchen table. And I was talking about some very heavy stuff, about depression and gold and interest rates and now we didn't have the Federal Reserve. Yeah, we had the Federal Reserve system then, and different things. And the only thing that the students took out of the class was, Dr. Joyster was born on the kitchen table. You know, woo! You know, that's not what I really had in mind that particular day as the chief thrust, you know, of my remarks. I was trying to explain the difference between Hoover and Roosevelt and the New Deal and the NRA and, you know, some of the other things. All right. You remember my, you know, for you, National Recovery Act, it was better known as the National Runaround. Yeah, right. Okay, anyway, who is this? Although the Depression was just making itself felt in this village of 1,500 located in Goodhue County, southeastern Minnesota, no visible panic or violence upset the population. Dependent as the townspeople were on the prosperity of their customers, the Norwegian Lutheran and the North German farmers, they continued to make do as best they could. Community life centered around the family and the few churches. We belong to First Evangelical Lutheran, the largest of eight North Lutheran churches within a 10-mile diameter of the town. Other kinds of organized social life were there also, but the church also always came first. Or so it seemed to the children who tried to resist the orders of parents who wanted perfect Sunday school attendance. Looking back, I never questioned my father's 40 years of involvement as a trustee or deacon, nor the long hours my mother spent at AID or the Priscilla Club. The only thing I can remember is that when Mother was at Priscilla Club, we always got dried cake and egg salad sandwiches for supper that night because she didn't have time for dinner. And Father was not pleased, but he passed it off as a sacrifice for the church with us. All right. Oh, anyway, this was my, and she'd always forget the hot dish, and I'd have to go back and get it. But anyway, this was my first. This was my first impression. Oh, I have one funny story there. I went to get the hot dish, and, you know, Jorsted was on the tape on the bottom. And I was walking out and stumbled and fell and dropped it on the sidewalk. And the minister's son was there, young Virgil Foss Jr. And there was this nice Pyrex dish all shambled. And he knew I was upset, and he said, "Will your parents be mad?" And I said, "My mother will be real mad." And he said, "Well, you can beat her up anyway." That was the way he had of solving his problems. If we're going to have an argument, I could beat her up. So I don't know what he had learned, but anyway, let's come back to the point. This was my first impression of organized religious life, and I accepted it as a part of the way the world worked. Religious faith meant being good, obedient, receiving a year-in, year-out nurturing from the minister, the teachers, and my parents, winning at memorization contests of Bible verses, singing in the junior choir, and staying away from the bad kids in town. We had Rats Klug and Stubb Vogan and Nuts Kispert and a few others that were pretty bad kids. All right, anyway, limited as that vision was by today's standards, I later learned that this was a fulfillment of the dreams of my ancestors going back three generations. Recognizing in the 1850s they had no realistic hopes for economic security in Norway, the Abbeys, the Vaxlands, the Jorsteds, and the Aragers simply left their ancestral homes and came to the good farmland in the upper Middle West. There they would claim their farms, build their churches, educate their children, and start over. A form, really, in the new world of being born again. And here's a remarkable coincidence that I'm going to mention right here. Once located in the area today around Holden Lutheran Church, that's a remarkable thing, and one thing that I, you know, talk about rootsy kinds of feeling. The church where they was were, and which my cousin today still owns all the land on all three sides around Holden Church, and it was my great-grandfather who gave the land on which Holden Church is built. Holden is simply the name for the place, you know, in Norway where most of the settlers came from. But anyway, and it has nothing to do with the explorer here, but it's a nice coincidence. Anyway, once located in the area today around Holden Lutheran Church, which is 7 miles from Kenyon, they founded the congregation in a typically frontier setting. Yet by contrast to other American frontiers, theirs, and keep in mind when I'm talking about the born-again revival thing, theirs had no revivals, no camp meetings or great awakenings. Such events were foreign to the pious, emotionally measured Lutherans who built the church, accepted the theological leadership of the minister, and gave their children the best religious education they could. The Bible, the sacraments, the sermon, the small catechism of Luther, careful attention to the liturgical year, and personal piety were the chief ingredients of their faith. Their hopes for a new life were expressed concretely when the congregation, this is a Holden congregation, endorsed the plans of the minister, the Reverend B.J. Moose, to found a college for their children in nearby Northfield, some 25 miles east of Holden and 40 miles south of Minneapolis. Somehow, despite the extremities and temperature, cows to be fed and milked twice a day, 52 weeks a year, the anguish of stillborn babies, and roller coaster prices for their crops, they persisted and somehow survived. On occasion of visiting Norske, filled with the fervor of the quickening emotion or quickening expression of faith through evangelistic preaching, would visit their community. They listened patiently to the stories of how a layman in Norway, Hans Nielsen Hauge, had brought new life and vigor to the moribund church, state church there, a movement which now spread to the farms of Minnesota. A few of the settlers broke away from the mainstream and founded their own mission congregation. But the great majority continued to believe, as they understood it, that God was active in their lives, worthy of worship and of their deepest loyalties. No altar calls, no harvest of souls found a place at Holden. Rather, the congregation continued to hold fast to what they knew and believed. Stable as their religious life was, the settlers could not prevent far-reaching social change from touching their lives. The farm simply could not absorb all the large number of children which soon appeared. Some moved to Minneapolis or St. Paul to find work. Others attended the new college nearby, St. Olaf, for indoctrination in the faith and the liberal arts. Still others, including Oscar Jorsted and Laura Voxelin, studied agriculture or home economics at the university in hopes of improving their homesteads. Yet Oscar was the third of three sons and eight daughters, with no chance of inheriting the farm. Laura, the third of five daughters and three sons, wanted to live in town. So again, something of a born-again experience occurred. They were married shortly after Armistice Day. That's after World War I. I have to explain that, a generation gap that I found. They were married shortly after Armistice Day, moved to Kenyon, and there founded Jorsted's Hardware Store. Theirs was a stable, committed faith, enough to convince them to invest their savings not in the stock market, but rather in an education for what soon became their three sons and one daughter at nearby St. Olaf. They knew this was God's will, and they obeyed. My parents provided us, without benefit of today's expertise in child psychology, with what they believed a family needed. Stability, piety, pride in our accomplishments in church and school, a sense of pride in work well done, and loyalty to the church. Looking back now, those childhood years had their intellectual limitations. But the sense of order and close attention the parents and the community gave us seemed worth the price we paid. Throughout those years, other churches sponsored visiting revivalist tent meetings with outside speakers. I saw my first altar call at the age of 13, but felt no need to come forward. I understood from confirmation that God was present in the sacraments, that his word was proclaimed in the sermon, and that we were indeed sinners in need of forgiveness. And my childhood or adolescent behavior left no doubt in my mind as to what a big sinner I was. And there was no need to get especially emotional about all this. I did get excited, however, about what I could, or what I would do with my life. That it would be devoted to the glory of God, I had no trouble in affirming. That I too would attend St. Olaf as did my brothers and sister I knew was in store. Yet I enjoyed writing about sports for the local newspaper. Why not do that? My enthusiasm for journalism received a mighty boost when I read that a fellow Norwegian Lutheran young man, Erik Severoid, had joined the ranks of writers, and a story beautifully told in his autobiography, Not So Wild a Dream, which I would recommend to you anytime for great reading. Severoid's Not So Wild a Dream. It's just a marvelous book, just absolutely superb. There was a life of adventure and potential for enlarging the vision of a child of the children of pious Lutherans. And if you think Kenyon is isolated, you should see Velvet, North Dakota, where Erik Severoid was born and raised. At the time I was thinking about that, my first direct encounter with an altar call experience occurred. The church's teenagers attended the annual summer Bible camps. This happened to be, some of you know, Green Lake at Spicer, Minnesota. There we heard earnest, freely witnessing Christians tell us about conversion and victorious living. They seemed so happy, so confident, so filled with conviction. One minister challenged me directly to give up sports reporting plans and become an ordained minister. I weighed his words as carefully as a 15-year-old could, prayed, and waited for an answer. Since the Lord moves in mysterious ways, a reply came at the highlight of the week's program, the consecration campfire. A highly emotional Lutheran evangelist had preached to us about full-time commitment. Tonight was not too soon. I remembered my meeting altar call, but stayed in my place. Then we sang a progression of hymns up from Kumbaya to the songs of dedication. The leader was crying rather softly and asked each of us to stand in turn and give our favorite Bible verse. The setting soon led us into a whatever you can do, I can do better kind of atmosphere. And soon we were adding fervent personal testimonials. None dare break the spell until a friend of mine, I remember Jackie Holt so well, none dare break the spell of the spell until a friend from nearby Wanamingo somehow realized this was not what he had known in his religious life. He undoubtedly couldn't at that time have given the reasons why, but he knew this campfire experience was somehow wide of the mark. He waited his turn for giving his Bible verse, then stood up, looked at the fire, and said, "My favorite Bible verse is, Jesus wept," and he sat down. I remembered that, and for reasons which I couldn't explain then, I secretly applauded him for it. Broke the whole atmosphere completely, just wiped it out. The decision about a career in the full-time ministry remained far in the back of my mind when I enrolled at St. Olaf in 1948. My plan was to take classes there for 1 year and so please my parents, get experience writing for the college newspaper, and then transfer to the University School of Journalism in Minneapolis, where York Severide had graduated. But that never happened. College life furnished enough continuity with my ethnic past to keep me feeling comfortable about that. Yet the teachers and students with strong religious commitment stretched my understanding of faith in directions I had never known before. I met again the challenge of the instant conversion decision. To impress a girlfriend, Donna Mae Simons, I remember so well. To impress a girlfriend, I went with her to Minneapolis, this was in 1950, to hear this exciting new preacher, Billy Graham. I was impressed with the enthusiasm of those waiting for the doors to open, and they were singing Heavenly Sunshine during a real downpour of rain. I don't remember the sermon. I didn't think anything was unusual about that at the time. All right. I don't remember the sermon, but I do remember my date asking me to answer the altar call. I just couldn't do it. I don't know why. New forces led me to reconsider my decision about the ordained ministry. Perhaps being a sports writer was not so good a way. To serve God was not the issue, but could it be done as a pastor? I concluded it was not. I was just not holy enough, not as filled with the conviction I had found in the clergy I had known. I hadn't thought then about the possibility of being a servant while still remaining a layman. To me, the only sure way to live up to the demands of discipleship, as I had observed these in my childhood, was to join the ranks of the ministers. Then something happened. Some impressive student leaders of the religious groups on our campus invited me to attend in late August 1949 the National Lutheran Student Association Ashram in Interlochen, Michigan. As it turned out, it was the closest thing I ever had to a born-again experience. Again, my understanding of the faith was stretched far beyond its hometown setting, as I observed the wide variety of students at the meeting. Some seemed highly pious and devout. Others displayed qualities of intellectual curiosity or personal impiety I had rarely seen among Lutherans, to put it mildly. Most of them, and this is a nice connection here, most impressive of all was the leadership of Dr. Morris Wee. His enthusiasm, wit, and sense of consecration helped infuse the ashram with a sparkle and excitement I had not known before. He soon replaced Eric Severide as my idol. And he also had earned a PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin, which will show up later. The decisive moment came in an evening program on Luther and vocation. The speaker was an Augustana Lutheran pastor from Ottumwa, Iowa, a Reverend Melvin Lundeen. He gave the kind of sermon that I could repeat right now. He developed forcefully the idea of our highest vocation being to serve God as a royal priesthood, a holy people, the whole Lutheran emphasis on divine calling. Oh, wow, I told myself, I'm going to be a minister. Then, after a brief transition, he spoke with equal conviction about the priesthood of all believers. Here was a concept new to me, although the Lutheran flavor was familiar. God wants people in all walks of life, from every station, starting with the street sweepers up to the most powerful princes, to serve him, and to see in their calling and life their full expression of religious commitment. Lundeen explained that Luther was breaking down the older Roman idea of the uniqueness of the ordained clergy. He emphasized that Luther found in the teaching of the priesthood of all believers the freedom which released the energy which led to the Reformation. God, he said, wanted shoemakers not to mark crosses on their shoes to show they were Christians. God wanted shoemakers to make the best shoes possible. And I remember that because 2 years ago, at a luncheon at the AAR, the American Academy of Religion convention in New York, the guest speaker was somebody vaguely known around here by the name of Christer Stendahl, and he made that same comment, and it always sort of stayed with me. I like connections, if you don't mind. Okay, anyway. That sermon simply exploded in me. I was 19, vulnerable, yet sure of my foundational faith, needing only the adequate career in which to express it. We had no altar call. This was at the ashram. We had no altar call, no testimonials around a campfire. But after it had ended, some oldie friends of mine invited me to have cherry pie down the road at a restaurant, famous for its famous Bing cherries at that time of year. I had thought earlier that day of doing that and had tried to get a date with a Carol Moe for the big ritual of cherry pie eating. But she had said no, so I had given up on that. So I declined the invitation, thinking Carol would probably be at the restaurant with another boy. I walked over to a sand dune and started sort of an internal conversation. What did all this mean? What was God telling me? That he was speaking to me directly, although not audibly in my ear, was certain. I cannot reconstruct that conversation now, but I can remember at its end, I reached into the sand, let it flow through my opening fingers, and said, "If you want me, Lord, I will follow you." That was that. I had made my commitment. That was God's will for me. I saw no angels, heard no choirs, felt more relief than excitement as I said those words. There was nothing left to do but to return to the cabin and fall asleep. Then at 4 a.m., my Oli friends, determined to celebrate the night by square dancing on a country road, woke me up. I thought this occasion did call for a celebration, even as in as bold a form as square dancing. And at St. Olaf in 1949, square dancing was bold. So I entered in, and in the event, as the eventful night closed with a rush of hollers, do-si-dos, skin knees, and laughter. Had this been a conversion experience? I asked myself that on the way home, but could give no answer. I remember my confirmation hymn. "Oh Jesus, I have promised to serve thee to the end, but what of that sand dune in Michigan? What did that mean? Where would it lead? Was I being told to be an ordained clergyman? I just didn't know." The decision, however, could not be put off indefinitely. One clear signal appeared when I started studying American history with the indomitable Agnes M. Larson. Her dedication and enthusiasm were contagious. Her wisdom learned from the study of the past was convincing. Her personal interest in my career was both flattering and sobering. Why had she singled me out for special encouragement? Perhaps I should be a history teacher at a Lutheran college. But then I wondered, was the study of history as pleasing to God as the study of theology? How could I tell? Another signal emerged when, between my junior and senior years, I participated in field research in London, England, through the University of Minnesota, what they call SPAN program, that is Student for Project for Amity Among Nations. This was my first visit abroad to the cradle of American history, now my favorite subject. Everything there delighted us. The residents from every corner of the world, and especially Speaker's Corner, where we heard the angelic cherub, we heard communists, and one calling himself Zacchaeus, preaching to us from a tree limb. I decided this is a big, exciting world, and I wanted to see a good deal more of it. In my research on what the topic was, on what the House of Lords was doing under the egalitarian socialist administration and power, I was testing my wings as a neophyte historian, trying to make sense out of the present by a consideration of the past. I liked it, and I liked it very much. Yes, I would be a history teacher studying the past to illuminate what I would later, in professional vocabulary, call the human condition. But could I do that and still honor my commitment at Interlaken? Wasn't teaching something I enjoyed so much really being a little more than selfish? Wouldn't my full expression of dedication be to enroll in a seminary? One voice in me said yes, another said be a teacher. The answer came not in a moment of personal crisis nor a peak experience, a la, you know, Abraham Maslow. It came in as mundane a setting as the college bulletin board, which is not exactly, you know, a hotbed of excitement. It occurred as in a setting of the college bulletin board filled with graduate school announcements. There I learned of the Danforth Foundation of St. Louis, which had just launched a new program to prepare college teachers. The statement of purpose that this program was to support for this program was that it was to support those who, quote, saw in college teaching their expression of religious vocation. Yes, I shouted when reading it. People around me thought I was a little crazy. There it was. There it really was. As a part of the application form, each student submitted a statement explaining how their faith informed and inspired them to serve God in the classroom. I applied for and found myself the recipient of a Danforth Graduate Fellowship in its first year. That's 1952. And in a sense, the first year of my life. By way of preparation, the foundation held a week-long meeting for all those selected. This was at Camp Minnewanka, not too far from Interlaken, and a remarkable parallel there just between Interlaken, where 3 years before, and coming back to northern Michigan just 3 years later. This parallel came home to me when the program director, Dr. Kenneth Brown, was describing to all of us the wide diversity of religious expression he found in the applications. He talked of everything, quote, from the deep sacramental understanding of the Roman Catholic faith of Frank Handler to the intense Lutheran piety of Erling Jorstad. I had never been characterized like that before, nor had I ever met any Catholics like Frank. We became good friends, and again my understanding of faith was stretched out further from its hometown origins. Encouraged by Agnes, I entered graduate school at Harvard. It proved to be a long way from the security of my past. Here were many of the great names in my field and some graduate students far removed from those I had known in college, in terms of intellect, commitment, and piety. I worked as hard as I could, feeling the pressures of high-powered competition. Yet I also found myself every Sunday worshiping at the Lutheran Church near Harvard Square. And interestingly enough, I was there for the installation of Henry Horn. I wanted to preserve my foundational faith, and I needed the assurance that the Lutheran assurances that the Lutheran atmosphere provided. I really wanted it both ways, to be open to the discovery of new ideas and new persons, yet remaining secure in what I knew was eternally true. As matters turned out, I was not to be a carbon copy of Agnes, who had her doctorate from Harvard. My grades were borderline, and I spent a good deal of time worrying over whether or not I would be invited back. Somehow I sensed I would be given a polite no as I returned home to Minnesota for the summer. I visited my sister and brother-in-law in Iowa, and when painting their garage, I had time for reflection. I prayed, asking the question I had asked at Interlaken. I decided that if I didn't make it at Harvard, I would try one other graduate school. If that didn't turn out, then I would be sure God was calling me to the ordained ministry. When I finished praying, I knew this is what God was calling me to do. Then came the letter from Harvard stating that, in light of the standards of our department, I should think carefully about withdrawing. I felt more relief than pain. I applied for and was accepted at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. It had a fine history faculty, I would be able to keep my Danforth Fellowship, and I would be closer to home. So in September of 1953, I set up shop, knowing this would be my last chance for success in the world of academia. But by the time I walked across the commencement platform at Camp Randall Stadium four years later, I was a different person, holding a new set of questions, new doubts, hopes, faith about the future, history, and what my question at Interlaken would be, what the answer to my question at Interlaken would be. Those years turned out to be something of a conversion in reverse. I slowly absorbed what Wisconsin in American history is most famous for, the economic interpretation of history. I learned to trust in the measurable, concrete argument that the only material, continuous struggle for wealth and power in the world was what really made people behave the way they did. Here in the economic realm was reality, the world the way it really was. The force that brought on revolutions, which divided political parties, and which split society into the haves and have-nots. Any talk about religious or moral commitment was a human rationalization for what really made us tick, namely greed. Well, that didn't seem so hard to reconcile with the Bible. The rich young ruler, the camel going through the eye of the needle, laying up treasures. These were passages that confirmed the fundamental accuracy of the economic argument. I really wasn't giving up on religious faith, I was just being realistic. Or so I told myself. I continued to attend church. I liked the hymns and liturgy, and the minister was a good deal more receptive to new ideas than those pastors I had known before. And Dan, this was Charles Poles I talked to you about. Yet I concluded the church really had no special claim to final truth. It was a useful way for capitalist power mongers to keep the have-nots content with their life. Organized religion was a human product easily understood as meeting the psychological needs of its followers. But anything like a claim to transcendent truth was only talk, wishful thinking. Who wouldn't like to have an all-powerful God, the Father, to take care of all our needs? It was simply too much to swallow. I could still be a decent person, a hard worker, a good teacher, and follow truth wherever it might lead, in a phrase I found in John Dewey, whom I read closely. Those moments of insight, of experiencing something close to a born-again peak experience, like at Interlaken, seemed like necessary but adolescent passages through which a real scholar must pass. But something else kept me from what I found Sigmund Freud calling the ritualistic slaying of the father, that is, the rejection of the faith of my family. I met Helen in a history class. I found she too was a Lutheran, active in her youth and religious activities with support from her deeply devout parents. I had been serious before about some girlfriends, but this time I fell in love. We had so much in common, so much to share and talk about, so caught up in the excitement of learning under great teachers and watching ourselves becoming thinking successful students. Those were exciting, demanding times, and we did very well at it. I enjoyed my first classroom teaching experience immensely, and Helen made Phi Beta Kappa and the Outstanding Senior Award for her class. Here was the real world, the testing and rewards of using our intellects to their highest capacity. Who could ask for more? Yet there remained that pledge to the Danforth Foundation about seeing in one's religious vocation, well, teaching as a form of religious vocation. And I had made a commitment to teach history at a Lutheran college. Could my new commitments be harmonized with those? Since God seemed to be talking with me so directly in those earlier moments of need, how could I simply throw out my decisions and still believe I wasn't subject to every new challenge, you know, that came along? I tried to work out some compromise. God didn't reside just in the churches. Personal piety, however desirable, was not necessarily a fruit of the workings of the Holy Spirit. Wrongdoings, which I once attributed to original sin, seemed unavoidable. but surely no one was writing down in some book up there in heaven all my misdeeds. I could still serve people, but now as an enlightened, rational scholar. But on the other hand, I was in love. Life was more than what the economic argument said it was. I concluded I didn't have the answers to all this right now, but someday they would be found. The euphoria of graduate school could not last. We had careers to launch, a family to start, and books to write. I quickly accepted an offer from St. Olaf to return, as inconsistent as that may seem, given my commitment to the economic argument and my doubts about organized religion. I wanted to help those undergraduates who were so much like myself to understand the crises of faith I had not really myself faced as a student there. I liked the idea of being a colleague of those teachers whose opinions meant so much to me, including Arnie's father. What I did not understand was that God was the hound of heaven, still pursuing me to honor the promises made at Interlaken. Things started well. Helen returned from a year's study and a master's degree in France. We were married and both felt highly pleased when President Clemens Gransko introduced us at the opening faculty banquet as new teachers. Over the course of the next 20-some years, a combination of ideas, people, and personal experiences brought me to recognize how I was, in fact, searching for the answer to Nicodemus's question. Remember, Nicodemus, what must I do to be born again? In a community which nurtured the growth of faith, rooted in asking the big questions, facing the doubts of my students, and being responsible for the lives of my family, I gradually could make the affirmations which I will present. Mine, I realized, was not to be a life suddenly turned around in a moment of unshakable commitment. As much as I came to respect the depth of my friends testifying to an instant born-again experience, I found another avenue open. The first direct entry into that avenue appeared through my association with colleagues who showed their commitment in their work. They demonstrated how the highest standards of scholarship need not be sacrificed by the leap of faith, that the economic interpretation of the human condition did leave unanswered questions. Above all, they helped me to see how shallow and narrow my earlier convictions about God's activities in the world were, how the many ways in which we come to a knowledge of his presence through Christ in the workings of the Holy Spirit can be found. God was not just in the church. That is what I had believed so much in Kenya. God was not just in the church, but his ways were to be found in all creation. I remember a throwaway line from Professor Harold Dittmans in an undergraduate class, which stayed with me. The more we know, the more we know about God. This came home vividly to me in the course of a two-year small group of faculty discussing monthly a major book of interest. We looked hard at Teilhard de Chardin's The Transformation of Man. We probed the implications of Skinner's Walden 2. We argued with John Mockestad over impressionistic and abstract paintings, over Buber and the Eisau dilemma. We searched Frohm's Escape from Freedom and worked through the Brothers Karamazov. At the age of about 30, I was ready for the Grand Inquisitor scene, and it has remained a fixed landmark in my spiritual understanding. By contrast to the faith of my youth and to the heyday of graduate study, we did not, when concluding a work, ask, well, how does this harmonize with Martin Luther? Or how does this present a winning testimony to the Lordship of Christ? We were saying, and I was considering for the first time, how restricting it was to put our religious faith in such confining restraints. God's ways with mankind stretched out far beyond the boxes in which I placed all that in my youth and at Madison. A second direct avenue into the new life emerged through the daily traumas and rewards of working with the students. Some of them pressed me for my understanding of religious faith. They had the audacity to believe us, the teachers, when we told them that college was a time for exploring, testing, experimenting, and learning from both classroom materials, from office conversations, and from their bull sessions. Their questions forced me to look more deeply at my own convictions than I'd ever imagined I could do. Not being willing to accept slick or vague answers, they made me reconsider the whole spectrum of competing world religions, personal preferences, and styles of expressing one's faith. As with my colleagues, the theme emerging from my encounters with students that proved to be the most helpful for all of us was that of avoiding putting God or faith in any kind of box. Boxes are easily classifiable, attractively logical in their clear boundaries, simple to keep under control, and therefore safe. I learned that through academic analysis and personal conversation, I could not close out the possibility of a personal breakthrough, or of seeing connections in a new way, of finding fresh answers to persistent questions. When the students discovered some of that, then I discovered it also. And that has been a very precious thing. Some might even call it grace. The third avenue of entry has been our marriage and the children. We wanted a family, and 22 months after the wedding, Eric found his way into the world, followed 14 months later by Laura. In marriage and in parenting, one glimpses a cosmos, nothing short of the knowledge of God's presence. The sacrificial love required, which is best expressed for us in Christ and the ongoing support of the presence of the Holy Spirit in times of crisis as well as in everyday life. In our quarrels, in our good times, in the shortages, and in the fears of parenthood, we could see what Peter Berger calls signals of transcendence. In all human attempts to understand the mysteries of the universe, the most persuasive are those which come from a faith that each act, each emotion, points to a transcending source of order, love, and forgiveness. From parenting, we learn the role of world builder and protector. Such a role requires that the world ultimately is not a place of terror, but of love, not darkness, but light, not hate, but peace. It would be tempting here to relate my favorite stories by way of illustration. Only two can be mentioned within the space available. We watched with both pride and apprehension as Eric grew up. If I break up here, just stay with me. The grounds for special worry were based on the fact that in her 10th week of pregnancy, Helen had contracted German measles. Our doctor, Donald Peterson, told us calmly but accurately what the chances for malformation might be. He also proved to be a source of grace in his counseling during the remainder of her pregnancy. As it turned out, Eric is of strong body, mind, and spirit. When he was old enough to understand the risks involved with the measles, he let that soak into his religious consciousness. Now he knows in the midst of his passage through seminary years that life is a gift, that grace abounds, and that by knowing that, he finds daily renewal and rededication for his vocation. A signal of transcendence? For us it was. From Laura and Eric also came a second convincing signal. At the ages of 14 and 12, they started attending the Friday evening meetings of the local Neo-Pentecostal prayer group in Northfield. They soon became actively involved, so I decided to see what this was all about. I found myself going regularly as both an observer and sometime participant in the first years of the charismatic renewal in this part of the country. This in turn led me to reassess my entire range of religious convictions. How could one explain speaking in tongues or prophecies or healings with the old answers? It proved impossible. I was led back again to studying the scriptures, to the commentaries by the great teachers of the faith, and to personal reflections. That gradually led me to realize that although never having received any of the gifts just listed in 1 Corinthians, in the manner described by the Neo-Pentecostalists, I found a resource for renewal first from my children and then from doing the research and presenting the findings on Lutheran charismatic renewal to a variety of audiences. All three entries to the Avenue came together in the mid-1960s when we lived in New York City, where Helen earned a master's at Columbia, and I started preparing under the direction of Professor Robert Handy at Union Seminary for teaching a new course at St. Olaf in the religious history of the American people. There I studied under the giants, Reinhold Niebuhr, John C. Bennett, Wilhelm Palk, Roger Shin, as well as Handy. There too, on Morningside Heights, we lived in a community far distant from the ethnic stability of my early years. In my diary, I tried to add up the meaning of the experiences at Union. What stood out was both the diversity of the participants, yet the strong sense of dedication to the highest standards of scholarship and expression of social concern. These people had no pigeonholes or boxes for God. They found in the neighborhood and in all of New York many opportunities for direct personal care for the oppressed and the weak. And in chapel and elsewhere, they strengthened their inner resources for spiritual renewal. This added up to a very impressive synthesis, one to which over the years since it occurred has nurtured my foundational faith. I found the avenue for renewal open more broadly on our return to St. Olaf. By teaching the religious history course with Professor E. Clifford Nelson of the Religion Department, I was able to carry out a sustained professional examination of the whole range of religious development in America, to study trends, rises and falls, alternative answers and options. This led me to reflect in a new way on the manner in which God deals with us. Further, by working with and listening to the gifted teaching of Dr. Nelson, I came to appreciate in a new way the strengths and challenges of the religious tradition of my youth. This renewal continued when in the mid-1970s I became a member of the summer teaching faculty at Holden Village, a retreat center for laity in the Cascade Mountains near Chelan, Washington. That became an unparalleled opportunity for trying out new ideas, learning from the teachers and guests, worshiping in a setting of magisterial splendor. There, too, my childhood roots were renourished again, this time by the inspired preaching of Pastor Carol Hinderly, director of the Village community. These added up to a rekindled enthusiasm for claiming those sources of renewal I had so long ignored. Justification by grace through faith, sola scriptura, and the priesthood of all believers. It was as though the circle had been completed. Having started in a classical Lutheran community and then traveling through the challenges of graduate school, seminary, and teaching the religious history of this country in all of its diversity, I found new and exciting renewal from the tradition of my youth. Yet I was not ready yet to admit that in any contemporary born-again form of explanation, I had known a total turnaround. Three major developments in my life now came in the well-known midlife crisis that awaited me before I found the need to look closely at whether or not the born-again experience had occurred. These three all came within a space of less than 2 years, which gives hope to those to wonder, is there life after 30? Which a book title asks. Wish I had that title. A great title, Is There Life After 30? And they don't mean 1930. In 1976, my body told me I might be having a heart attack. My doctor reached a negative diagnosis but recommended I have an angiogram and other tests. I reflected on why God allows such suffering to occur, on why, as our loving Father, He does not heal us from such pain. I realized I couldn't answer that question. In some way, I knew Christ was there standing with those who suffered, showing us by His sacrifice and strength what faith in times of the most profound crisis could mean. When the cardiologist showed me that all I had was a hiatus hernia and not cardiovascular disease, I felt a powerful sense of once more having an opportunity to carry out the promise of Interlaca. Physically, I was sound. Spiritually, I felt reborn. A second ingredient appeared when the children left home for college. So much of my own religious nurturing had been involved in raising them that I wondered whether that faith might not now start to dry up. It suddenly struck me that perhaps a new chapter in my life had begun. A new opportunity for discovering the promises of God was being opened. A final turning point came when I was asked by the college to supervise the study of 16 students from 1 month in Taiwan and 4 months in northern Thailand. We had been told about culture shock. Among the many forms that shock took, none struck with greater force than living in a culture virtually devoid of the familiar Judeo-Christian anchors of my past. I remember once meeting a Pastor Johnson, and he said, I am 50% of the ordained Lutheran clergy in Thailand. Well, stayed with me. I studied carefully the Thais, their worldview, the Four Noble Truths, the Triple Gems, the Road to Nirvana, and other teachings of Buddhism. Yet for reasons not still altogether clear, that experience reminded me once again of the nourishment of my lifelong foundational faith. Within the short span, the major elements of my life came under a fresh scrutiny. The return to the faith of my ancestors, the realization of mortality, the lack of opportunity to be a day-by-day parent, and the insights of seeing the world through the eyes of another major religion. I could only answer with other questions. Where is God leading me? What has He been showing? I have tried in this brief autobiography to explain why my understanding of being born again took the course that it did. In those powerful experiences of my very recent past, I came to understand that I did not have to choose between the instant and the nurture positions. When I understood all of John 3, I understood that God's promises are true, and that although as I as a sinner have failed to trust in them in every instance in my life, the promises remain steadfast. Through events such as described in this story, I have been born again every day. My life story and my affirmations come together as one way of discovering the promises to be true. To be sure, the story is not complete. My understanding may well be enlarged in the future. But as we seek today to understand the puzzles of the current born-again movement, what I affirm is my contribution to this controversy. 49 years. Well, last year it was at Easter, and kids were home, and they got used to it. After a while, it's just like Spence got used to it on the skiing trip. Every so often, a very loud shout would appear from the study, and I'd come out screaming. I really believe it. I really do. It's really there. And they would say, "Okay, Dad's writing," you know, and we talked. Yeah, but I mean, technically, in these terms, I kept notes, but you know, going over the logs and the journals and everything. But I suppose about a month. But it's worth it. I really recommend, you know, for all of you to, and it's not, you know, remember the first month here in January we talked about the narcissistic personality. It can be. You can sit and feed, and wasn't it Bonhoeffer who kept talking about taking your spiritual pulse every minute? You know, and that can really be dangerous. But every so often it's necessary to sit back and reflect. not every minute, but often. But not, you know, you can't say it. You can't set up a course.
It's interesting how the two Holdens were yep. full circle.
The two Holdens were the full circle, really. I started, because if any of you have been at Holden, you know, in southeastern Minnesota, it's worth going to. It's a marvelous, old, traditional 1920s architecture Lutheran church. And it's worth seeing just as a superb example of the kind of dedication and the sacrifices that the people made. It's true everywhere. I could show you Spence Knows, what's that little town now on the way to Montgomery? Vesely, and it's a fantastic Catholic church. And the way those people, you know, that whole area, New Prague, Montgomery, Lonsdale, all that, the way they, you know, they made the church so important in their lives. And it's the same thing that's true there. And it started, yeah, that's a good observation. It started there, and, you know, the other Holden where it came back full circle again. Yeah, strange.
How many times have you given this?
This was the first time.
First time?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Are all questions open earlier?
Sure, all questions.
I'm curious, and maybe it's because it's so recent, it's too painful, but you didn't include your divorce as part of your...
No, that was deliberately because Helen said that she didn't want that public. Yeah. And, yeah, that's why. No, I don't. You know, I don't mind talking about it. But
no, I just would have thought that you would at least have considered it.
Yeah, but that, frankly, and that gets into sort of the triumphal living, victorious living kind of thing. Many of the best sellers out of, we call them the Wheaton and the Grand Rapids publishing houses, deal with all sorts of things like that and get to be, quote, almost lurid. You know, mm-hmm. I was a teenage dope addict, you know, the Nikki Cruz syndrome,
yeah.
And that kind of stuff. And you know, all that, it just bordered too much on, quote, you know, soap opera and lurid kind of things. And that just didn't fit. I mean, it just didn't have a place, no. At all. I thought a lot about it. But that's another story. Yeah. But it just, you know, it seemed just inappropriate. I guess that's mm-hmm. the best way of putting it.
And what are you doing now?
I was talking with John this morning, and Jim and Kay and the others. I'm applying for permanent sabbatical leave from St. Olaf College. But somehow, maybe with a new president, maybe I've got a chance. I've known Harlan since 47, and we've always been good friends. I think they should have, don't you think? I mean, you know, just the reward of, I mean, the status of being able to say you have one permanent person, you know, I mean, permanently sabbatical. I think that has real class. No, I'm going back.
In other words, you want to ski for the rest of your life?
No, the next time is, some of you know, Doc, and I'm lucky enough in the fall of 81, I'm going to take the tour that Doc took.
Have you heard for sure on that?
Well, yeah, there's...
Tour?
Well, there's, we have St. Olaf has a... And some of you know Sue Clark, and she's been here lots of times. And Sue is now the international, to talk about connections, Sue is now the Director of International Studies at St. Olaf. And she's been at Holden many times, in dance especially. And we have several overseas programs, and on three of them, one to the Middle East, one to the Far East, and then one to what they call global around the world, they send faculty advisor along with them, more or less just as somebody to see that everything goes all right. Let's see. Doc got up to the Himalayas, but somehow I'm not quite ready for the Himalayas. The trail junction I can handle, but the Himalayas... Himalayas might be something else if you want to go up to Kathmandu. Yeah. Well, a lot of it's in the library, the book, Bold in the Spirit. But I'm pretty academic there because I didn't want to get too closely involved, although there are a couple times where it comes through with this. I'd be glad, you know, to talk about that at whatever length you want. I believe it's real. I believe it's genuine. I believe it's of God, and I believe that it's helpful, and it's not for everybody. And there are different kinds of gifts, and what's happening is that we've learned that there are all kinds of different gifts, and one problem that the charismatics now have overcome, and I've talked, oh, I don't know how many times, in summer of 78, we had a fine group. I don't know if you remember, John, that group from Davis, California, we had a fine group here from Davis in 78, and I had, that was the first sort of real turning point that I had found with talking with charismatics, that they recognize that there isn't a hierarchy of gifts any longer. Because for a long time, what had happened with the Neo-Pentecostalists was that they had taken the list from 1 Corinthians 12, you know, 4 to 11, and said this was it. And they still, and even among them, they made differentiations. And I can quote you Larry's book, or Larry Christensen's book, in which he said there were some of those nine gifts were even, you know, higher than others. And that, as far as I can tell, with a few exceptions and very few exceptions, has just disappeared completely. And then it's more 1 Corinthians 14 now, where the all members of the body is a much more mature understanding. David Proy still doesn't address the Lutheran Charismatic Renewal meeting in Minneapolis, while the Archbishop of St. Paul, Archbishop Ropch, does address the Catholic Charismatic Renewal, and the day David goes down and talks to them is going to be a real step ahead, I think, for David. But he hasn't done it yet. But he does talk. Larry and then the other leader, Norris Vognes, have had long personal conversations with. No. This was one of the things. That's one of the astounding. Because the best evidence was that that we have in medical terms. And maybe there's new. If there is, I'd be glad to hear it. But that in 1941, in Australia, there was a severe outbreak of German measles. And the researchers there took most of their evidence from that because it was so clear to understand. And 41% of the fetuses were in one way or another malformed. Yeah, which is a pretty high percentage. Yeah, 41%. But that's the best evidence that they have on a large scale. Yeah, and it's so silly because some, you know, I don't know what word to use. I mean, something like cancer or something else makes no difference, you know, for the fetus, but something as ordinary and routine as every day is German measles. You know, I mean, that's about as routine as you can get, I mean, next to the common cold. And how that ever happened in the scheme of things is, you know, is a question I want answered, you know, later.
So he's active.
Oh yeah, yeah. Some of you'll be here this summer. Very, very active. Yeah, Dan.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer this question, but you grew up in a real strong, what was called Lutheran Pietism.
Very much. Right.
What part of that maybe have you kept? What part have you thrown out? How does it still? You know, how does it still influence you? Do you still fight it in some way?
Oh, yeah. Spence heard me fighting it the other day. Sometimes I simply feel the need to curse. Just not because of any... not because I'm telling anybody anything, but I'm still getting back at the fact that all those words were no-nos.
You're still mad at Pastor Foss.
I'm still mad at Pastor Foss. Yeah, I told you about that story with Pastor Foss, right. About that. He meant well, you know, but and so on. And the pietistic thing shows through in so many ways because I think it's on tape here somewhere. I gave a Vespers here in 76, and I remember we were, Spence knows, and Tom, a delightful thing in Northfield is take a canoe down the Cannon River. It's really, and if any of you ever have the chance, then I'd be glad, and oh, by the way, you have a standing invitation at both the Wees and at my place, you know, if you ever need a place to crash in Northfield, you know, that's it. But anyway, there's a wonderful place to take a canoe trip, and it was a day, just a beautiful spring day, and so I took Eric and Laura out for a canoe trip. And we're having a great, the kids are having a marvelous time, absolutely superb time, and all of a sudden, about halfway through, and some of you here will smile when I say this, I looked at my watch. And my God, all those boxes at home, and I wasn't there working in my boxes and moving papers from one box to the other. And I was guilty because I wasn't working. And I spoiled the whole thing by chugging away and getting back and docking out at the back, you know, the Red Owl store and kids were mad and crying and the whole rest of the things, but I got back to work, really. And that's, you know, and I remember some of you, I don't know if, well, you know, we have one teacher, Sue Dannenbaum. I don't know if any of you remember her, but anyway, she always said that I feel guilty when I'm around the home and I'm not working. And that comes some out of Lutheran piety and some out of simply my father's total dedication. I always remember he always had a headache on Sunday, and he had a headache on Sunday and only on Sunday because he wasn't at work on Sunday. And by 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, if mother was busy or grandma or her mother came around or she went out to see grandma or something else, dad would sneak up to the store. And then his headache would go away, really. I mean, it was as simple, clears up. But I think that's part of it with the piety thing. But it's mainly the idea that unless you're working and doing what you're supposed to do and all the rest, that there are very clear rules of what's right and wrong, and that, you know, it's that old quip that H.L. Mencken made about Puritans, Puritans is that suspicion that somebody somewhere is enjoying themselves. And it's a golden oldie, but it's always a good one. I would say that would be the main legacy, if you want to call it that. And that doesn't go away, you know. Emily told me it's no use fighting it.
Is there any part of it you celebrate?
Kind
of your pietist background?
Oh, yeah. Mostly, how do I say it? I remember it came so well. My sister lives in Forest City, and we got talking with, I don't know if any of you know Pastor Gangsted. And they were there one day for dinner, and we got talking. And we got talking about the different kinds, the different forms of expression in liturgy. And I hope some of you play the tapes that Gordon Lathrop did here in 76, because they were, or I forget 78, I forget which, because Gordon was on the LBW committee and so on. And you know, he's at Wartburg, isn't he? Yeah. And we got talking about the different things, the tensions, you know, between silence and, you know, and between the spoken and, you know, the everything else. And what I'm trying to say is directly is that the thing that that keeps me going, I think, more than anything else, is the liturgy and the music in the church. More than anything else, it's that. And that liturgy shouldn't. This is what Lord Gordon helped me overcome so well. Liturgy shouldn't be just one thing. Liturgy should be many different things. There should be silence. There should be time for, you know, for speaking. There should be, you know, spoken. There should be, you know, all forms, all things. There should be action. There should be, you know, no action. You know, all these different things that should be going on. And somewhere, and when I was talking with Pastor Gangsted, at first I felt a little guilty about this, because really, in a sense, what I was saying was that I'm not paying that much attention, or I'm not really that excited about, you know, the proclamation. It's the music that does it. And that's, you know, you tell a minister of 25 years that, and, you know, some of them might resent that a little bit, but Orrin was, that was no problem at all for him. And for my brother, who's a pastor in Tucson, the same thing. And it's the music out of that does this. And the only other place that I found it, and I found it, you know, in excelsis, as the only word for it, is in the Anglican or the Episcopalian tradition. I always remember in one of the greatest experiences, and this ties in with Holden too, was at Christmas at 78, another person who grew up literally at Holden was Andy Hinderly, and I were at the St. Andrew's Episcopal Church for Christmas. And it is, I suppose you can't, you know, give numbers to this, it's one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life. When in David's Royal City, and I remember the dignity of the carrying the crosses down the people's vicar and the warden's vicar and the, you know, the whole thing was just overwhelming with this, and I, you know, I felt just as much at home in the Anglican Church as I did there. Yeah, I suppose out of the whole tradition that would be it as much as anything else. Although sometimes I've heard sermons like, we were fortunate enough the year we were at Union to hear at Riverside, we had Robert McCracken, and one of the great, of course Riverside is one of the great pulpits, and he was the one who had replaced Fosdick, and he's one of the greatest preachers, and he's Presbyterian, one of the greatest preachers, and that just stayed with me, the sermons. So And that's difficult, and this is one problem obviously we've talked about here. You go home, I had that at Union after hearing Robert McCracken, and we had somebody named Virgil Fox on the organ, every Sunday, which as I think I mentioned to some of you before, here, sure beats Myrna Johnson, back at Bethel Lutheran, who hits a few blue notes, every so often. It's very difficult, but then you have to realize that life is in Bethel Church and it isn't in Riverside. So, I guess that would be the most important things, of that. And always, how do I say it? Respect isn't the word. The thing, well, I'm going to read it tonight, that's why I didn't want to use it now. But the fact that, God's promises, God's truth, the word is there whether or not we feel it or understand it or respond favorably to it or not.